This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Today we hear from both the Republican and Democratic candidates in Michigan's 3rd Congressional District. Coming up, Democratic challenger Bob Goodrich. But first, Republican Congressman Justin Amash is seeking his 3rd term in the U.S. House. He currently represents Battle Creek and Grand Rapids in Michigan's 3rd District. He joins us today at Western Michigan University's Kendall Center in downtown Battle Creek. Justin Amash, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Gordon.
And we're also joined today by Battle Creek Inquirer Executive Editor Mac McCullough. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Justin Amash, why don't you begin by reintroducing yourself to our audience and tell us what you would like to do with another 2 years in the House.
Well, I'm the congressman from the 3rd District. I've represented this area over here in Calhoun County for the past 2 years, and I've represented Kent County and Ionia and Barrie and that region for about 4 years. And served in the State House before I was in Congress. I'm from the Grand Rapids area. I am married and have 3 kids. And my main goals as a congressman are to ensure that people's rights are protected, to follow the Constitution and make sure that we are protecting civil liberties and looking out for the interests of ordinary Americans.
Mac McCullough, first question for Justin Amash.
All right, Congressman Amash, I just came from a meeting of about 100 people where the Coordinating Council of Calhoun County, and I asked them to what question I should ask you. We were talking about the United Way's recent ALICE study. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. It's a study that tracks how well people are able to meet basic needs, living above poverty, being employed, but being asset challenged. And the question was, how does public policy or the absence of it contribute to the high number of ALICE families in our communities?
Well, public policy has a huge impact. I mean, what we do at the federal level, but more importantly at the state and local level, affects families every day. And from my perspective, most economic decisions should be made as close to home as possible. So people in local communities need to make those decisions, and certainly working with your state legislature and working with the governor is the most critical element. A lot of times when the federal government gets involved, you end up with actually a lot of misallocation of resources because federal representatives don't have the same connection to the local community that maybe a state representative does or a local representative. The issues are just very different. So I prefer that you handle these kind of issues at the local level. And when policymakers decide that they're going to push for corporate welfare or allocate resources in a way that is inefficient, it can have a huge impact on the community.
Let me ask you about foreign policy. Do you consider the group known as the Islamic State or ISIS or ISIL to be a threat to national security in the United States?
There's certainly a threat to people overseas. I've been in classified briefings, and what I can tell you is that the administration has not made a strong enough case to members of Congress, certainly many of the members I've spoken to, that ISIS is a threat to people here in the United States. So those are very different things, whether they're a threat overseas or here in the United States. We've certainly seen the atrocities they've committed. Some of the acts are horrific, and those who commit atrocities, we should certainly go after those people. But when you're talking about launching a full-scale war, you need to have, I think, strong evidence that there is a threat to people here at home.
Can you kind of define there, you say go after people is okay, but full
sure, if someone, if there's a video of someone beheading someone, certainly that person is a fair target. And those who assisted that person are fair targets for the President of the United States to go out and seek out to destroy them. But when you're talking about launching a full-scale war, perhaps an invasion of another country, then you need to have a stronger case that there is a threat here to the United States.
Mac.
Well, so you believe that the president is exceeding his authority?
Yes, absolutely, exceeding his authority.
Well, is his authority limited then to covert operations at this point, unless he goes to Congress for something more?
His authority is limited to actions that are repelling attacks or dealing with imminent threats. Every president has that authority that's under our Constitution. He has that executive authority. But when it comes to launching a war, he certainly has to go to Congress. He has to go to the American people and make the case. And the people's representatives in Congress and the House and Senate have to actually vote on an authorization to allow the president to launch offensive strikes.
When you say that you'd have to see more evidence, would you have to see evidence that ISIS is actually coming to American shores before they would get your vote for any authorization?
No, I wouldn't take it that far. I would say that you have to see evidence that attacks are being planned, that they are interested in attacking here at home. And I don't want to go into the details of what I hear at classified briefings, but it hasn't risen to the level where I think it is appropriate to launch a full-scale war.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans at the Western Michigan University's Kendall Center in downtown Battle Creek, speaking with Congressman Justin Amash, who is seeking his third term in the House. The Republican represents both Battle Creek and Grand Rapids in the 3rd District. And also here is Battle Creek Inquirer Executive Editor Mac McCullough. Mac.
I'd like to jump to immigration, the issue there, and really describe your idea for immigration reform. What can Congress or should Congress be doing?
Well, there's a lot that Congress should be doing, and the question is whether we'll get Republicans and Democrats to come together and take the actions that need to be taken. Most members of Congress on both sides of the aisle think that we have to have some major immigration reform. There are differences of opinion about what that will entail, but I think you can get a consensus behind a few significant items. First, you have to have strong border security. And that's the place you have to start, certainly if you're going to get Republican votes in the House and in the Senate. Without strong border security, you don't have the assurance that you're going to be able to prevent further illegal immigration. So you have to have that. You have to improve our legal immigration system. There are people who have come here for generations. Most of our ancestors came here as legal immigrants. And that's to be encouraged, and that's something that is special to our country. We're a country of immigrants, and we believe in following our Constitution, following a set of principles, but we all come here as immigrants. So we don't have a national identity based on ethnicity like many other countries do. Our national identity is based on our beliefs, our belief in liberty and freedom. And we need to improve our legal immigration system. If you don't have a good legal immigration system, you encourage more illegal immigration because there are people who want to come here to work or to live, and because they feel they don't have any opportunity to even apply and make it into this country, they take more desperate measures. And so I would improve our legal immigration system. I think most members of Congress would agree with that. And then when it comes to those who are here illegally, you're not going to go house to house deporting people. If someone is caught committing a crime, they're caught in the act, yes, you can deport that person. But we're not going to send federal agents house to house to find people. So we need to create a system to bring people out of the shadows, to give people an opportunity to achieve legal status that doesn't mean citizenship, but just an opportunity to come out and become legal. And that would be over a long period of time, and they would have to pay some penalties as well.
You had a pretty strong response to some of the video that came out of Ferguson, Missouri, after the shooting death of Michael Brown there, specifically to the disturbances that happened and some of the equipment that the police had. If it was up to you solely, what would be the federal policy in terms of having some of this military equipment end up in the hands of police?
I think it's a mistake to send military-grade equipment to police. There are people involved in SWAT situations where someone is holed up in a house and they have hostages where the police certainly need better equipment. But what we shouldn't see is police on the streets pointing weapons at protesters and decked out in gear that is military grade in a way that frightens the population. I think we need to be respectful of the concerns of communities and ensure that people feel that the police are there to protect them and not to frighten them.
Is the role then for the federal government to say, yes, we can provide you that equipment, but there's some limits on when and where you can use it?
Well, that's one possibility. I think there are certain situations that might require a better police equipment, but the type of equipment we're seeing on some of the streets and the type of equipment being sent to police officers throughout the country are beyond what would be normally used in those situations. Sometimes we're talking about grenades and other items that probably don't have a real use in typical situations. And the way the law is written right now, these local police are required to actually use these items within a period of time, or else they're denied access to them in the future. So it's the federal policy actually encourages local police to put these into use and to put them on the streets when they might not be necessary.
Mac.
Shifting to education, should the federal government have any role in setting standards for public education for the states?
I don't think so. The state governments should handle these issues, and certainly I would prefer that standards be handled as locally as possible, even more local than the state government. When the federal government gets involved, it sets a one-size-fits-all policy for the whole country, and you get state governments and local governments that become so dependent on the federal government that they stop competing with each other. They follow the federal standards, for example, with Common Core, and if they can't abide by those standards, they lose funding. And that's a dangerous situation where you have local governments and school districts dependent on the federal government to set all the standards and dependent on them for the funding. You end up with basically no competition across the country.
But the other side of Common Core, they'll argue, look, we're in a worldwide competition right now. And frankly, people move around a lot more than they used to. So shouldn't there be some sort of national standard that everyone's got to reach, at least a bottom floor that everyone's got to be at?
Not a federally set standard. I think that if you had local governments deciding these things, state governments deciding these things, that would be a better system than what we have now, because you'd encourage more competition. You'd actually be able to raise standards. But the way you have it under Common Core, school districts are actually punished for being creative. They're punished for not following the Common Core standards because they won't receive federal funding. And I've consistently opposed things like Race to the Top and No Child Left Behind, because I don't think the federal government should have that role. It stifles innovation, it stifles creativity, and our kids are too important to have just a one-size-fits-all policy for the whole country. Some kids really struggle with certain types of learning. Other kids are great at other things, and we should have our teachers with the greatest flexibility possible so they can decide how they teach their classrooms to get the most out of their students.
We're down to just a couple minutes left. I want to ask you a little bit about the label that gets put on you quite often, libertarian Republican, libertarian-leaning Republican. How much are you libertarian? How much are you Republican?
Well, Republican's my party. Libertarian is my philosophy. So I don't think there's any contradiction there or anything unusual about it, just like there are liberal Democrats and progressive Democrats and conservative Democrats. There are different types of Republicans, and I consider myself a libertarian Republican or a conservative Republican. All it means is that I believe in following the Constitution and also allowing people to make decisions for their own lives. Those are the principles I follow every day as a congressman.
Justin Amash, thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Republican Congressman Justin Amash is running for re-election in the 3rd U.S. House District, which includes Battle Creek and Grand Rapids. We've been speaking to him today at Western Michigan University's Kendall Center in Battle Creek. And thanks again to Battle Creek Inquirer Executive Editor Mac McCullough.
Thank you for inviting me.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Democrat Bob Goodrich is the candidate in Michigan's 3rd Congressional District. He is challenging incumbent Justin Amash for the seat representing Battle Creek and Grand Rapids. Bob Goodrich joins us at Western Michigan University's Kendall Center in downtown Battle Creek. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. I'm glad to be here.
Also joined today by Battle Creek Inquirer Executive Editor Mac McCullough.
Good morning.
Bob Goodrich, why don't you introduce yourself to our audience and tell us what you'd like to do if you're elected to Congress.
Well, I operate a chain of movie theaters. I've over the years also operated commercial radio stations. I now have a few non-commercial stations, but my theater operation in Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, and Missouri have given me the capacity to be a contributor and active with the Democratic Party for some years. I've known Mark Schauer for a number of years, and by coincidence, Gary Peters, I've known these men personally for some time. And when I suggested back in the early spring that I be the candidate, because there didn't seem to be other people volunteering to run, and sadly, because we don't have public financing for campaigns, it takes someone who has some personal wealth to run. I was able to and have been able to essentially fund my own campaign. And what I wanted to talk about was the transition we're going through in this country. As I showed you, the yard sign that I'm now hoping to put up now that it's getting within a matter of 40 days or so of the election is a focus on women's participation. In the last midterm election in 2010, nearly a million registered Democrats did not vote, and it was just an enormous tsunami of non-participation. People just stayed home in droves. And a significant part of the people who didn't vote in 10 were women. And, you know, I've been suggesting to party leaders that, you know, as we look at the election of 2012, it's fascinating that nearly 70% of white men in America voted for Mitt Romney. And it's been my life experience that the Republican Party is really quite a fraternity. There's the operative words of loyalty and fidelity, and there's a kind of a collective sense of team amongst the men that I know that are just by habit Republican. And they don't seem to be addressing some of the circumstances that we have in our country, and that's the distress a lot of people without income are experiencing, and the why of it. And I wanted to talk about the fact that there's a variance between the focus of the male Republican Party and what I'd like to think it would be the focus of the Democratic Party. Millions of Americans and thousands of people in the 3rd Congressional District are having distress. There are very few jobs right now, and those that are available are modest pay and relatively short hours.
Let's get to some questions. Mac McCullough of the Battle Creek Inquirer, first in question for Bob Goodrich.
Well, great. You brought up wealth, and yesterday I attended a community meeting here in Battle Creek about the absence of wealth. Nearly half the households in Battle Creek are unable to meet basic needs. How does federal policy, or what can federal policy do to remedy that?
Well, there's been a dramatic reduction in the taxes in the United States. Our tax level in relation to our gross national product is the lowest it's been since the First World War. And sadly, the term tax cuts, when I talk to men of, you know, I do enjoy playing golf, and so I talk to quite a few men, and I, you know, just socially I'm talking to people, and they take great joy in tax cuts, and I point out the tax cuts inevitably mean somebody's lost their job, whether it's a fireman or a park ranger, a clerk in the court system. And because there's been such a dramatic reduction in public funding, we're really distressed to assist people. You know, there's, you know, the general employment. We all know what's happened to factories and how the robotics have changed a great deal, how computers have changed, as I was describing, the office environment, even the motion picture environment. And I really don't have an answer with the difficulty the government has right now in funding, services. Our water treatment plants haven't been upgraded in generations. Our bridges and roads need attention. We've had significant reductions. I had the good fortune as a younger man to go to law school, and I have law degrees from the University of Michigan and from New York University. Phenomenally, those degrees were essentially paid for by the public. When I was in college years ago, my summer job essentially covered my education. Obviously, that's not the case today.
I want to shift to national security. There's a debate in Congress right now and elsewhere about how much the United States is going to do about the group known as the Islamic State or ISIS or ISIL. But I want to make my question a little more broad for you. If you are in the United States Congress and a president, whether it be President Obama or a future president, is asking authorization to send U.S. troops into harm's way, what are the criteria that you would want to see that say, yes, we need to send troops into that situation?
Well, we have to back up. The United States is not Norway or Ireland, just a modest-sized country. Our military budget is the equal to all the rest of the world combined. There are about 208 countries in the world. There's the 207, and then there's us. And we have over 1,000 military bases overseas. We are, just by who America has become with our enormous military presence, a factor in the conflicts that are occurring worldwide. And there is, over the last 50 years, the developed authority that the president can act on an interim basis, albeit, arguably, is it 30 days? Is it 90? Is it 120? It's a short period of time. We haven't declared war now in almost 70 years. Clearly the Congress should be, because hopefully the Congress is representing the public as opposed to special interest. And, what is the, resolution of these conflicts, particularly like in the Middle East, that have been in existence for over 1,000 years? I mean, it's what we're dealing with right now is, we have the Sunni-Shiite conflict, the Alawis that are part of the Shiite world are now the rulers in Syria, and we're, theoretically not supportive of the Assad family, but the Islamic State is, an enemy of Assad. By helping defeat the Islamic State, we're indirectly assisting someone we don't want to assist. It's a real puzzle, and I don't have an immediate answer. One thing I do know is that, as evidenced by everything I've done in my own personal life, you've just got to be analytical and observant and ask questions and try to get guidance and not... have some kind of ideological shortcut as to what to do. I mean, this is really an incredibly complicated matter, and there's a sadness to the inevitability of reversion. Look, we thought we had something resolved in Iraq. We were all hopeful, and it's proven to be unstable, and that could happen again.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. We're speaking with Democratic candidate for Congress Bob Goodrich. He is challenging Republican incumbent Justin Amash in the 3rd District, which includes Battle Creek and Grand Rapids. We're speaking today at Western Michigan University's Kendall Center in Battle Creek. Also joined today by Battle Creek Inquirer executive editor Mac McCullough. Mac.
Just to follow up on that, do you believe the United States allocates too much of its wealth to military and defense?
Well, it's an enormous amount, and it's not really being challenged. Almost all our foreign aid is directing countries to then re-spend that money back in the United States with the Lockheed Martins and the Boeings and the General Dynamics, the multiple multi-billion-dollar companies that provide weaponry and armaments. It would be interesting if we could direct our foreign aid to other purposes in countries other than militarization. I don't have an immediate suggestion. Clearly there has to be inevitably some force that can deal with, you know, hostility potentially aimed at America. Clearly, our national safety is of paramount importance, but we have so much that has been devoted to military activity. I mean, just astounding how many military bases we have overseas and what part of our economy is based on weaponry. You know, I'm not wise enough to say, you know, what adjustment should be made, but it's got to be revisited. And I think my hope is that there could be more people like myself that ask questions versus follow a rote pattern. And that's largely why I'm running for Congress. You know, I've been able to be observant of who I've had to deal with on a commercial basis. I think I could be equally analytical when it comes to public activity. And I believe my opponent is a bit, I think he'd be a great college professor because he's got a lot of theories. I don't know how observant he is of real life.
If the Affordable Care Act were going to be revisited and perhaps changed in some way, what changes would you want to make to it?
Well, I find it exhilarating that we now have 14 million people that have signed up and hopefully another 15 or 16 million people over 100 years, starting back with Theodore Roosevelt, there's been a hope to have some kind of universal health program in the United States. So we're the only country literally in the world that did not have it. The principal focuses of the Affordable Care Act are obviously covering people that were not covered with pre-existing conditions or lack of finance because they didn't have an employer program. But also, we're trying to address hospital costs. Hospitals are buying equipment and looking to patients to use them. It's really more a use of material and services versus health care. And the digitization, so the Affordable Care Act is looking at really scrutinizing and challenging hospital costs, and they're calling for the digitization. Right now, we rely on our medical treatment, the memory of our doctors. By digitizing, the doctors then can look at a man or woman of a certain age, certain ethnic background, certain weight, height, and get data that can give assistance to that person's medical treatment because it's in a bigger pool than previously been. So there's a great deal of change coming through the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, it's not going to take that much more time before the benefits of the Affordable Care Act. It's kind of interesting right now that the Affordable Care Act is polling very highly, but Obamacare is not. And that's an interesting comedy, but it's real. The words do seem to carry how people think about it.
Mac?
So you wouldn't change the Affordable Care Act?
I would like to see it enhanced. I'd like to see, like all countries in the world, everyone living in Scotland or Greece, Romania or Bolivia is got medical coverage. We're still going to exclude millions of Americans who are in our country but not citizens, and that's regrettable. So over time, I mean, healthcare, Franklin Roosevelt in 1944 had an economic bill of rights and a State of the Union address and called for jobs, which I wish were more plentiful, but healthcare as well as freedom of religion and just basic necessities of lives. I think healthcare is a human right that I'm glad we're now addressing.
Just about at the end of our time here, so let me ask you, Justin Amash won this district pretty comfortably in 2012, even though it was a big Democratic year. Is there reason to believe that this is a winnable seat for a Democratic candidate?
It's been almost 60-some years. Jerry Ford became a congressman by challenging a then-incumbent Congressman Jonkman. That was the last primary challenge. There was a great deal spent in the primary of August of this summer. And in the primary, the incumbent received 52% of the vote. 44% of Republicans chose not to vote for the incumbent. That gives me, as a challenger, great hope. The circumstance of the primary changes my position.
Bob Goodrich, thank you for your time.
Okay.
Bob Goodrich is a Democratic candidate for Congress in Michigan's 3rd District. He's challenging Republican incumbent Justin Amash for the seat, which includes both Battle Creek and Grand Rapids. We've been speaking today at Western Michigan University's Kendall Center in downtown Battle Creek. And thanks again to Battle Creek Inquirer Executive Editor Mac McCullough.
Thanks for the opportunity.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.